This broadcast is based on personal opinion and experience. Some words in this program may be offensive to some listeners, however, only used for describing actions from some content from years past. The words used are not the viewpoint of 93.7 Voice of the Shuswap or your host on Global South. Happy New Year! Hi, my name is Catherine Seal, and welcome to Global South for January 2019. Global South is about bridging the gap between us here in the West and the Global South, a term relating to the developing world. The program is about breaking down cultural barriers and broadening the horizons of people who have never been exposed to various cultures abroad, or in your own backyard, maybe out of fear, maybe just from lack of money, or maybe just by listening to the news, you have formulated your own opinions about what goes on in the world around you. And maybe you're just too busy with everyday life to step out of your box to see what really is going on in the world. Today's show is a bit of a biopic about me and why I created this program for 93.7 Voice of the Shuswap, and why I find it's important to step out of your box once in a while to see how the other person lives, and move beyond TV commercials and propaganda, and in this case, advertisements about sad, starving African children lying in the streets, and start asking questions about the facts and realities of what goes on behind the scenes in regards to global aid initiatives and our very own biasness, whether it be in Africa, anywhere else in the world, or in your own backyard. As I found out, you shouldn't always believe what you hear. Over the next few months, you'll be listening to me chat about colonialism, global aid and aid organizations, corruption, gap building, paternalism and the dependent syndrome, the rule of law and socioeconomic issues, and much more, with the odd interview thrown in, reference to my own personal experiences, and references from some of my favorite best-selling books on Africa and its place in the world. I want to begin by reading a selected passage from Dambisa Moyo's Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa. We live in a culture of aid. We live in a culture in which those who are better off subscribe, both mentally and financially, to the notion that giving alms to the poor is the right thing to do. In the past 50 years, over $1 trillion in development-related aid has been transferred from rich countries to Africa. In the past decade alone, on the back of Live 8, Making Poverty History, the Millennium Development Goals, the Millennium Challenge Account, the African Commission, and the 2005 G7 meeting, to name a few, millions of dollars each year have been raised in richer countries to support charities working for Africa. We are made to believe that this is what we ought to be doing. We are accosted on the streets and goaded with pleas on aeroplane journeys. Letters flow through our mailboxes and countless television appeals remind us that we have a moral imperative to give more to those who have less. At the 2001 Labour Conference, the UK's Prime Minister of the time, Tony Blair, remarked that the state of Africa is a scar on the conscience of the world, and that the West should provide more aid, as, thus far, amidst the multiple problems facing Africa, the continent has received inadequate amounts of aid. Deep in every liberal sensibility is a profound sense that in the world of moral uncertainty, one idea is sacred. One belief cannot be compromised. The rich should help the poor, and the form of this help should be aid. The pulp culture of aid has bolstered these misconceptions. Aid has become part of the entertainment industry. Media figures, film stars, rock legends eagerly embrace aid, proselytize the need for it, unbraid us for not giving enough, scold governments for not doing enough, and governments respond in kind, fearful of losing popularity and desperate to win favor. Bono attends world summits on aid. Bob Geldof is, in Tony Blair's words, one of the people that I admire most. Aid has become a cultural commodity. Millions march for it. Governments are judged by it. But has more than $1 trillion in development assistance over the last several decades made African people better off? No. In fact, across the globe, the recipients of this aid are worse off, much worse off. Aid has helped make the poor poorer and growth slower. Yet aid remains a centerpiece of today's development policy and one of the biggest ideas of our time. The notion that aid can alleviate systematic poverty and has done so is a myth. Millions in Africa are poorer today because of aid. Misery and poverty have not ended but have increased. Aid has been and continues to be an unmitigated political, economic, and humanitarian disaster for most parts of the developing world. Dambisa Moyo is Zambian-born with a PhD from Oxford University. She is an international economist and author who analyzes the macroeconomy and global affairs. She currently serves on the boards of Barclays Bank and Chevron Corporation, to name a few. She previously worked for the World Bank and Goldman Sachs before becoming an author and international public speaker. Although she lives in New York, she is considered one of Africa's most powerful women. On today's show, I'm going to share with you my story, a story that goes back perhaps 4 years, but maybe longer. I grew up in Calgary with my parents and an older brother, a rather conservative, typical white family of hard-working middle-class means. My parents coming from British Scottish lineage, my brother was a Russian, although he'd deny it today, and I am the great-granddaughter of the United States' most infamous gangster you could imagine. I'll leave that up to your imagination. Anyway, so yes, I'm a little Irish and a little Italian. So yes, you got it. Doing the DNA dance must mean that my brother and I were adopted. However, it didn't really matter. We were white living in Canada. Did you know that being born white meant that you were born into privilege? It's really a matter of opinion, of course. I don't care if you're born rich or poor. It's privilege. It's just up to you what you do with it. Before my journey, I never realized that. I just thought I was one of a billion people living on the planet, going to school, getting a job, getting married, and having children. Growing up in my family meant sitting around the kitchen table for supper. My mom did the cooking, my brother and I did as we were told, and my dad was the breadwinner, even though my mom had a part-time job now and again. I realized as I grew older that my thoughts and opinions were different. Maybe it was that DNA thing, but I'm not really sure. But anyway, I found it disturbing to listen to my father and my brother talk about the Jews, the Pakis, the Wops, and the Yellow Horde, or whatever other ethnic race or religion there was at the time, around the table. Apparently, there were good Indians, though, but most of them were drunks. I found myself questioning the people that raised me, their morals and ethics over time, trying to pin down why racial slurs had to be part of the dinner time talk. Over time, I started sticking up for minorities because these slurs were just downright mean, and it was really the right thing to do. Most of the slurs and indignations were all a part of ignorance, like so much of it is today. When the novelty of one race or religion wears off, another takes its place, and today it's the Muslims who are getting the brunt end of the attack. I believe if we were all to live or venture into the country where people originated or immigrated from, things might change. Perceptions might change. I found this out when I started to travel the world years earlier. When you actually take the time and sit and converse with people and ask questions, and bigger yet, when you are able to open your mind, big things do happen. Here's an example of a dialogue I had with a couple from Iraq and Yurgroup Turkey in 2008. I was traveling by myself and ventured off to Yurgroup in Cappadocia, which is a historical region in central Turkey. Pardon my pronunciations. The couple, whose names are Cloud and Ali Hatim, both proud Sunni Muslims, both government ministry workers who worked for Saddam Hussein prior to his demise in 2006, and both on holidays away from Iraq visiting Turkey the same time I was. We met at a little cave hotel in town and began to chat. The following day, I asked Cloud if she and her husband would like to join me for dinner, and she accepted the request, leaving her husband back at the hotel. Just two of us women strolling down the whitewashed narrow alleyways and cobblestone roads looking for a reputable restaurant in town neither one of us knew very well. It's been 10 years, so I couldn't tell you what we ordered, but I'm sure it probably had something to do with kebabs, chicken, and yogurt. We sat across from each other conversing in such a way to find out how the other lived. It was a true meeting of East meeting West for the very first time. A moment to make a difference, I thought. We talked about her two girls, the oldest being an architectural engineer going through her senior year in business management at the University of Baghdad. I told her about my children, my job. She talked about her job. We talked of the war in Iraq, her viewpoints, her hatred of the Americans and George Bush, and the atrocities that occurred with the invasion of the U.S. military. People wanted Bush dead. She went on to agree that Hussein was not a saint, but it was better than what was happening as a result of the Bush invasion. Many civilians killed, many left homeless. I'm not too naive to think that atrocities don't happen in every war, but I actually paused and felt ashamed of myself because it hit home that living in the West, next to one of the most powerful military outfits in the world, could be capable of war atrocities that we are not necessarily privy to, made me a little pissed off. When you hear things like this, right from the horse's mouth, so to speak, it makes you ponder your role in the bigger world. After I paused for a moment, I came back with a defensive remark. I suppose you could say, I suggested that the majority of Americans at the time were not in favor of military advancement into Iraq. I suggested not to be angry with the people or civilians of America as they are only following government rule. This was a fascinating experience, one of which I will never forget. You see, what it did open up was the door for understanding and realization on a smaller agenda that no matter where you live, you want the same things. These things include work, to see your children grow up, be happy, and live in peace. Our chance encounter opened up years of dialogue, although we never did see each other again. In 2015, I received a letter from Cloud's oldest daughter, Sana, looking for help to get out of Baghdad. At the time, their lives were threatened. I informed them of what I could do, and I have not heard from them since. In 1989, I got married and moved to British Columbia. 12 years later, separated, found my dream job, and raised my children. In 2008, I made the connection to my biological family, who are world travelers. And in the same year, my adopted mother passed away from natural causes. She died from complications of dementia. Her onset of dementia was noted some 10 years earlier, and with the disease came the release of her vocal filter that kept her quiet for so many years. Her true, racially biased color shone through to the forefront. Even in the most populous of areas, her Anglo-Saxon superior roots came pounding out, and her hatred for anyone else not white was spewed into the masses. Oh yes, there were a few messes to clean up along the way. Anyway, for her sake, she passed away. I was left with an inheritance which I put to good use. I traveled. I traveled to Australia, Europe, Hawaii, etc., but was not satisfied with the same Western taste that was left in my mouth when I returned home. My first solo trip of all places was to Egypt in 2012 during the revolution, and then back to Turkey, one of my favorite places. And this is where my life changed forever, by way of personal experience, and not on a tour, but by traveling alone, meeting people of every ethnic, race, and religion, living their lives, going to school, working and paying the bills, just like everyone else in the world. And no longer for me anyway was the division of East and West, and the whole Muslim thing was just that, irrelevant. Propaganda on both sides of the equation has created such an injustice, so much so that we continue to generate the wheel of hate, and we do it to ourselves through social media and the news. We must always remember that there is always the good, the bad, and the ugly in every country we hear about or visit. In 2013, I decided I wanted to go to Africa, to Kenya and Uganda, to immerse myself into the culture, visit a friend in Jinja, and of course be the consummate tourist by going on a couple of safaris. Wow, utterly breathtaking. I wanted to go for a number of weeks, and I thought the only way I could afford this after doing the research was to volunteer for a couple of weeks, doing what I knew best, which was paramedicine. So that's what I did. 2 weeks of traveling, and 4 weeks of, not paramedicine, but actually teaching. Teaching botany and science, teaching grade 6 East African history and social studies, and sex education and life skills in a small little town in Owasso located a couple of hours southwest of Nairobi, the capital of Kenya. I think I learned more than my students in the 4 weeks I was there, including how to withstand a bout of malaria on Monday and be back in school by Thursday. It was quite an adventure. So here's where the real adventure begins. Why I started a project in Kenya, with a twist, and why you're listening to Global Aid today. Ready, set, begin. It all started with Maurice McCauley in March 2014. I was introduced to him through a mutual acquaintance, which spiked my spidey sense as I was a little uncertain of the reason behind the meeting. I had only been in Kenya about 4 weeks and was bombarded with requests for money, sponsorship, boda bodas, which are the poor man's taxi, or to be more exact, a motorbike, and even cars. But I went into the meeting with an open mind and within minutes was not disappointed. Yep, it was sponsorship. Maurice was a man in his late 40s, I suspect, a paramedic by Western terms who once had been employed with the Kenyan Red Cross. However, he left due to corruption. Maurice was looking for sponsorship to help fund and stock his ambulance, which was donated by a fellow from Britain. His vision was to service for free the Kibera slum in Nairobi, one of Africa's largest, 2.5 square kilometers with an approximate population of 2 million inhabitants. He wanted to offer a free ambulance service to the people of Kibera. Otherwise, people went without medical service or transport to the hospital until they are able to pay up front. I could see the passion in his face, the way he spoke, that he was very sincere about his plans. I told him I was sorry, but I could not help him as I did not have money or the time to aid in his endeavor. But what I did say was that I could help him in finding ways to promote his vision through local fundraising schemes, advertising, or proposal writing. It was interesting to see the look on his face. I wasn't sure if he was dismayed, disillusioned, internally upset, or actually curious about how this idea could work. As it turned out later, putting the work into the idea was something he didn't really want to do. And when I think about it now, maybe I didn't quite understand the logistics of that either. Knowing what I know now, it was a bit of both. After our discussion, he took me for a ride through Kibera, then for a tour through the Nairobi National Hospital, which was an eye-opening experience in itself. I should take a moment and point out that hospitals depending on local and foreign funding make all the difference in cleanliness and healthcare. But even with standards being what they are in Kenya, they turn out some pretty good doctors. Maurice even took me out for nyama choma, grilled meat of beef or goat, which is a specialty in Kenya. It's always tasty, although a bit chewy at times. After lunch and the tour, we went back and sat in the ambulance, a Mercedes model donated by Maurice's British sponsor, which was barren of many supplies, but nonetheless a beautiful vehicle. We were talking about his project, and he brought up the topic of funding proposals, and as I listened, he asked me if he could sign my name to the proposal. His request took me off guard for a moment, as I thought it was a bit strange, so I asked why, explaining to him that I didn't live here. His response was, quote, "You're white and from the West," unquote. You're white and from the West. Wow. I was scrambling to think of something to say, and today I still can't remember, as I write this monologue, what my initial reaction was. But I think I felt tremendous naivety and very small in the world. Here's where the box where most people live is suddenly, powerfully, and unexpectedly thrust open. At that moment, things as I knew it changed forever. I can't explain fully what those words did to my psyche. Remember when I said being born white meant you were privileged? In my mind, being white brings power, superiority, and the very ability to change outcomes. It's a choice and it's a responsibility to do what's right, and of course to do the very opposite if inclined to do so. The Ku Klux Klan is very symbolic of what I consider the opposing viewpoint of what is ethically and morally right in my opinion. Here's an epiphany on the world order. The three things I learnt in point form from that phrase after some thought were 1. Global and local inequality by the way of colonialism and neocolonialism. 2. Paternalism and the dependent syndrome. And 3. Corruption through the theft of intellectual property and socioeconomic injustice within the country through inconsistent rule of law. These three things we'll address in later shows. I remember leaving that discussion with Maurice with a sense of being disconnected from the world. but I had learned a valuable lesson. The prejudice of the people living in my own community was much bigger than I, and much bigger than anyone would imagine if you hadn't heard it with your own ears, especially coming from an entire continent of people where whites were truly the minority. It was a personal epiphany. For someone else, it may have just been meaningless words. And maybe I was just in the right place at the right time in my life where I was emotionally available to absorb the impact of what those words meant. Moving forward, I landed on Canadian soil, always happy to be home. I went back to my life, work, family, and entering into and taking another general interest course. I love to learn, so every year I take a course through distance ed. I chose a British Columbia history course. As it would have it, it must have been fate or a predetermined destiny that I picked that course because it became the catalyst that would drive me back to Kenya and Uganda over the next few years. It would open doors, create projects, public speaking engagements, broaden my socioeconomic and political understanding of the world, and make me realize that we really live in a world of choices, good, bad, or otherwise. It made me realize my friends and community were not my closest allies at times, and where I made friends afar, that would impact my life more so than those next door. My course essays were always written with a newly enlightened passion, backed by facts, which always elicited a comment by my instructor, who mentioned that if I felt as strongly about the world order, I should write a book. Not sure I would write a book, but that being said, I felt it time to try and make a difference, and not just for the people in the world who are being marginalized, but even for the people at home who don't have the time to leave their box much, and for my own emotional well-being, which was being challenged quite intensely at the time. The BC History course reading material came from a book called The West Beyond the West, and is written by Jean Barman. When I started the course, I thought it would be dry. Remember social studies in high school? I guess now, with maturity and now wanting to take the time to learn a little bit about my home province, I started reading. I guess when you have empathy for people, and in this case minorities, given what had transpired earlier in my life, I became fully absorbed in the book, which not only focused on political and economic timelines, but on the plight of British Columbia's Aboriginal peoples from first contact right through to the impact of residential schools to today's present situations, dealing with the ongoing environmental issues, increasing suicide rates, and much more. It really drove home the impact of colonialism and its relationship to our Indigenous populations and their near eradication and constant struggle for their rightful place. Although I was never directly involved in the near demise of a culture, my own color, race, or however you want to label it was. And the question is, are we still? My passion for change lies in Africa, but the same sorts of issues are relatively the same here in British Columbia today, minus concrete borders and substantial cultural differences. The big difference, however, is that we didn't leave present-day Canada to go back to the motherland like we did in Africa or India. We stayed. My choice to move forward came with the idea of a rural first responders program in Kenya, but it came with a twist by way of a documentary called Poverty Inc., which was a 2014 U.S. production produced by Michael Matheson Miller. The documentary investigates the complex global industry of foreign aid. The combination of what I first learned firsthand through Maurice McCauley and the message put out by the documentary, which I completely agreed with, made me realize that something had to be done, but much, much differently. Different meant dropping my idea to provide a first responders program in rural Kenya, and different meant going against the global aid model. So what does that mean to you, you might ask? Well, first off, although a first responder program in rural Kenya, or anywhere for that matter in Africa, might make sense to many, as it may save countless lives, does it really make sense in the big picture? It's just another organization going to a third world country, doing a good deed, but does it truly change or benefit the people's lives in the long run? Would this program add to the problem, as have countless other aid programs, regardless of their benevolent intent? Benevolence in its entirety is good. Global aid organizations have saved thousands, if not millions, of lives. But after close to 70 years, these programs are still in effect and show no signs of abating. Global aid has become big business. People in the West are making a living off the poor in developing countries. But the poor are still poor. Global aid is a band-aid approach to a long-term problem. Yes, the people in rural parts of Kenya may have wanted the program, which was apparent when I was doing my research. But how sustainable was it? Here are the factors that persuaded me not to move forward with this program. 1. Sustainability. How was this program going to be funded and who was going to oversee it when I left? I believe that funding needs to come from within the country. Like other countries in the world, there is a percentage of wealthy living in Kenya that make between $1 million and $1 billion per year. These resources need to be tapped. I personally wasn't on the 20-year plan. I wanted to go in and get out, leaving people with the resources to run it their way, the African way, not the way I wanted. The idea is to work together, pass off the project and its objectives, and leave. Paternalism must stop. 2. The dependent syndrome. This is a big one. Who living in the country that is trustworthy enough was going to step forward and maintain and run the program after I left? People and communities need to be independent. Global aid organizations, when needed, need to come in, do their job, when it's an emergency, and leave. They shouldn't stay for 20 years providing continuous handouts. This creates dependence. This creates disparity and destroys local economies. Kenyans, for the most part, are well-educated and very resourceful, but they lack jobs and employment opportunities are difficult to come by. One thing I did find, which I think is crippling, is the mentality that we in the West have encouraged over the years through colonialism and continuous and ongoing global aid initiatives. Who does it benefit? For those people from our community who have traveled abroad to developing countries, landing on the tarmac, people in the West are inundated with requests for money, sponsorship, or goods. For me personally, as I've mentioned before, it's been cars, boda-bodas, and sponsorship for children's education. The percentage of people in these countries looking for handout usually are found in the lower socioeconomic tax brackets, which make up approximately 40% of the population. We should consider that a portion of the indigenous population make more money than we do, or I do. So why are they not moving forward in creating and maintaining programs that help their own people? In Kenya, I was pleasantly surprised to find a large number of indigenous organizations created internally by people who want to give back to their communities. But those organizations are still funded in part by out-of-country funds. My opinion is that if we discontinue this form of aid reliance to a certain degree, depending on need, of course, that wealthy people in the country may step up in time, and the country's government would be forced to move forward to work on sustainable economic reforms rather than rely on aid. After being in Kenya for some time, I have asked the question to Collins Kodak, a human rights activist and community support worker, and a guest on Global South, about the discontinuation of aid. He simply stated, "It needs to end. It has done nothing but cripple our country on a social and economic level." And I agree with him. Moving forward, yet again, I decided that if I were to go into Kenya with a program, knowing what I knew by now, that doing so would have to go against the global aid model. I wanted people to be self-reliant, and by doing so, a program would have to be created that could be sustainable by local individuals. I would need to bow out of any or all responsibility and return home after a project was up and running within a designated amount of time. So I went from a first responders program in rural Kenya to the Mahuri Innovation Project in Kisumu, Kenya. The Mahuri Innovation Project is a local and global economic program whose objectives required the project to be fully funded by the local and national community within Kenya, and where a network of professionals that are African would sit on the board and also be mentors for future entrepreneurs. What the country lacks also is employment diversification. The entrepreneurial spirit needs to be encouraged so that employment opportunities increase. As stated before, there are many educated people within Kenya at a university level, coming out of school, unemployable, working as taxi drivers or boda operators, trying to sustain their families on meager wages. Most individuals want government jobs, typical white-collar jobs that are promoted in the country, but there are not enough to go around. Trades training needs to increase, as well as small businesses with big ideas to expand the local, national, and international market. When I was asked to do a public speaking engagement at Mizzino University in Kisumu in 2016, the one question I asked was, "How many of you have the skills leaving university to become an entrepreneur if you couldn't acquire work in your designated field?" In a class of 30, none put up their hands. At a public engagement at La Savannah Country Lodge and Hotel, I asked pretty much the same question to a room of 50-plus people, and I received the same response. I also noted years back that when I taught school at the elementary junior secondary level in Nuwasu, that I taught strictly out of the book or syllabus. So, for 50 minutes, word for word, I wrote what was in the book onto the blackboard, partly because there was not enough books to go around for each of the students, but it also seemed the norm. There was little time for questions and certainly no time for creativity. If someone had a creative streak, it wasn't encouraged, especially in rural areas. However, prior to my last departure from Kenya, a new curriculum was being developed that may address some of the issues I just described. Creativity and training is two of the keys to the entrepreneurial spirit. Interestingly enough, my good friend Collins and I went and did a little experiment. In Manyara, a slum outside of Kisumu, we sat in a boda shed, kind of like a bus stop would be to us here at home. It housed at least 20 to 30 boda operators with their bikes ready to go to work, just waiting for a call by a client or someone requiring service to maneuver around the city. We went and sat and chatted about economic and aid initiative issues and what the Mahuri Innovation Center was about. As it so happened, after people were comfortable with a white woman chatting with them, a young man in his mid-20s came and shared with Collins and I his creative side. Unbelievable drawings, which I thought right away would grant him rights into the graphic design industry, creating logos for companies. At that moment, I wished I had the ability to grant him his niche in the world. It made me think we were onto something here. To find individuals in Kenya located in all four corners of the country, poor, middle class, or otherwise, to bring them together and co-create with them in the entrepreneurial spirit an opportunity for advancement into whatever market they fit. This is what the Mahuri Innovation Center was to be about until finances ran out, my own personal money. I didn't want to go against one of my primary objectives. I didn't want to fund this project from home because I knew there is money in Kenya. I didn't want to add to the dependent syndrome that had been going on for years. This system needs to change. We need to stop feeling sorry for the people in these countries, and we need to start having a mind for the poor. How can we really benefit the poor if that is truly what we want to do? To end this program today, I will leave you with this quote from Magat Wade. In order for Africans to be respected, we need to be leaders in the mainstream of global culture. As long as the West thinks of us as poor, suffering people in need of their constant help, we will never be perceived as proud peers in the co-creation of the best culture. Every Westerner who sees Africans primarily as an object of pity needs to stop for a moment and reconsider just how demeaning such a viewpoint really is. And once they become enlightened to the fact that we Africans are creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs, they need to get busy co-creating with us and purchase the best of our products. This is a quote by Magat Wade, Senegalese entrepreneur. She is the Forbes top 20 youngest most powerful African women listed in 2015. In the next few shows, I'll be discussing colonialism and neocolonialism, the pros and cons of global aid organizations, and bridging the gap between global north and global south countries, and much more. If you have any questions or comments, please write to globalsouth@voiceoftheshoeshop.ca. Global South, one word, at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, one word. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.